Office of Lawyer Regulation v. John A. Ward. Arguing for Mr. Ward is Attorney Craig W. Nelson. Mr. Nelson.
Thank you. I am Craig Nelson. I represent Attorney John Ward. Mr. Ward is not here today. That's at my request and some feelings I have about distractions during something like this just to myself. He is very interested in the case. I believe he's probably listening online. And he wanted me to thank you, and I thank you myself, for allowing us to present to you today. We think this is a very important case, obviously, to Mr. Ward, but also to the OLR, the attorneys in the state, as well as to the court. The case itself is about a $5,200 reimbursement ordered and a public reprimand. It's obviously been litigated fairly seriously, and the reason for that is because Mr. Ward and I believe that he did not commit any ethical violations at all. In fact, he performed, in our view, legal services that were good, and he would have continued doing that had he not been fired when Ms. Summerhill got upset after a hearing that was lost primarily because she lied, and it's undisputed that she did lie to the family court commissioner in Milwaukee and had a bad result and then fired her lawyer. We believe that the record does not support the finding of violations in this case, that the referee made obvious errors at the request of the OLR, which encouraged these errors. In this case, we think that the record does not support the violations, and from a bigger picture standpoint, it seems to us that in this case the OLR is asking for special rules for itself with respect to a number of things, including summary judgment standards, discovery, sequestration rules, the hearsay rule, and rules relating to expert testimony. And frankly, as indicated in the briefing, there are, in our view, so many different errors that it's difficult to know where to start, but I will start with the decision on venue, because that seemed to be at the center of much of this dispute. And it is a question because the OLR alleges lack of diligence in a three-month delay in bringing a motion for a change of venue. And Mr. Ward says there was no delay. I decided not to do it. And parenthetically, it's undisputed in this record, and I believe undisputed in the law, that the question of whether, when, or how to move for a change of venue in a particular case is a question for the attorney in his judgment as to the means to be employed to accomplish the result. The experts in this case testified to that. The rules clearly say that in our view. Now, the question is, did he neglect to do it or did he decide not to do it? And the answer is he decided not to do it, and that's what he testified to, that's what he said, and nobody said anything otherwise. I will take a minute, just a minute, I hope, to summarize why he decided not to do that. And the primary reason does not relate to guardian ad litem Mason, as the referee suggested. The primary reason for not moving for a change of venue was a tactical decision that Mr. Ward made as a result of the hearing on May 7th in Milwaukee. Mr. Ward went to Milwaukee for the visitation case, and he had prepared a draft of a motion before he went there. He decided not to use it. He went there to see basically what I would call the lay of the land. Who's involved? Is this person going to be represented? Is this person going to be pro se? What are the chances of getting this resolved? He raised the venue and jurisdiction objections. They were denied by the family court commissioner. I won't digress, but I will tell you that probably she was wrong in that respect. But it really didn't matter to Mr. Ward because of the outcome of that hearing. The outcome of that hearing was consistent with what the client wanted. She didn't want any visitation between the father and the daughter. And the result of that hearing was, not only was there no visitation order, but there wasn't even an order that a guardian ad litem be appointed. And it was likely in this case that unless a guardian ad litem was appointed, there probably wasn't going to be a visitation order. So On May 7, Mr. Ward knew that between May 7 and August 1 at least, there would be no visitation, and he knew that that's consistent with what the client wanted.
But could I ask whether Mr. Ward ever agreed with his client that he would move for a change of venue?
He did not agree that he would move for a change of venue at any particular time or in any particular way. When he first saw this client, he said the case has to be decided in Kenosha. And that's a reference to the TPR, the Termination of Parental Rights Action, that has to be filed in Kenosha. It will be decided in Kenosha. There's no other way to have it done. But he did not promise, he did not agree, he did not say that he would make a motion for a change of venue at any particular time.
Did he say he wouldn't?
That he would not? No, he did not say that he would not.
So he heard the client's wishes and was silent.
I would put it this way. I don't think that the client came into his office suggesting that there was or was not a good venue for this thing. She acknowledged that she didn't know anything about what was a good venue or what wasn't a good venue. And that, again, goes to the tactics in the case. Even if a client walked in and said, you know, I know a lot about venue, and this case ought to be venue, the visitation action ought to be venue down here for such and such a reason, that might be of interest to an attorney, but it certainly wouldn't be binding upon him to go out and do it that way, especially if he didn't think it was a good idea.
Counsel, are the findings of fact of the referee with regard to this discussion clearly erroneous? I specifically refer to finding of fact 12 in Appendix 7, which states, Mr. Ward continued to assure her that although Mr. Harris's case was filed in Milwaukee, it should be moved to Kenosha because that was where Ms. Summerfield's family resided. That's number 12. And then number 13, finding of fact, Mr. Ward did not follow through on filing a motion for a change of venue with Judge Gooley. According to his billing statement to Ms. Summerhill, dated August 8th, he drafted a motion to dismiss an affidavit and the motion for change of venue, an affidavit in support regarding the Harris petition in Milwaukee on August 6th for a total of 8.4 hours for research and drafting. Those are some of the findings of fact. Are there any findings of fact that you're asserting are erroneous with regard to that issue?
That last...
Clearly erroneous?
Pardon me?
That are clearly erroneous?
That last finding that you read was fairly long, but as I listened to it, I believe that it was not, that is not itself erroneous. Unless there is a reference in that, and I didn't quite get it all, but unless there is a reference in that to... time being spent researching venue, it would not, as I heard it, be erroneous. But the first one that you mentioned, did he continue to assure her during this time that it would ultimately, I forget it.
It should be moved to Kenosha because that was where Ms.
No,
Summerhill's family
that,
resided.
That is incorrect. That is incorrect. There's no evidence to support that that is the case. When the referee cites evidence about this alleged, what she calls repeatedly a promise, to move the case, okay, that there's no, in this transcript, the word promise does not occur. He did never promise her that.
This is to assure her.
He did not assure her that it would be done. The referee cites two pages, like I think 21 through 25 of the transcript, and in those pages you will not find that being said. What she said was, we talked about venue, and he assured me he would file, he would take care of my family and file the things that had to be filed. That he would take care of my family and file whatever had to be filed. But he did not say that at any particular time or in any particular way, it's a good idea to move this venue.
Let me see now. And finding of fact 7. Which is on Appendix 4 of your brief. Prior to the hearing, Ms. Summerhill discussed with Mr. Ward the appropriateness of a change of venue from Milwaukee to Kenosha based upon the fact that the mother and child lived in Kenosha and also that the cost of having Mr. Ward travel back and forth to Milwaukee would be eliminated. Mr. Ward assured Ms. Summerhill that this would be done.
Yeah.
That's not correct?
I don't believe that's correct. I believe that if you read the pages of the transcript that I referenced, it's something like 21 to 25, and then if you read my cross-examination of her, it does not come out to a statement that it had to do, that he was assuring her that he would do that at any particular time. I do think that he, again, I couldn't find that. She did testify that she said something to the effect that one reason that he told me it should be moved is because it would be cheaper for me or less expensive for me. I think she did testify to that. And, I'll just answer it that way.
It's one thing if counsel were simply considering a question of strategy, irrespective of any directives given by the client. I think you'd have a very strong case there. What would concern me is if the client said, I want venue moved, and counsel said, okay, I will, and then he simply didn't do it.
Well, I would agree with you if that were in fact the discussion, but that was not the discussion. There is no evidence. Her testimony, I have to tell you, her testimony on this question, very evasive. She could not remember, and ultimately on cross-examination, she said, I didn't know anything about venue. I'd heard about venue, but I didn't. She admits that she has no basis upon which to evaluate or conclude that venue ought to be changed or not. I believe that if somebody walked into my office and said, I'm a lay person, I don't know anything about it, but I think the venue ought to be changed, I would say, well, that's good, that's interesting. But you don't know anything about it, and so I'll make that decision. And if the client said, no, I want it changed, then I would either terminate the representation or move to have it changed. But that's not the facts here. It's not the facts here. And it can be read. I do encourage that to check if what I'm saying is true. But what she said is that he assured me that whatever had to be filed would be filed, not that he was going to go to Milwaukee on May 7th and move for a change of venue. And by the way, he was open to moving for a change of venue. He discussed it with her that, you know, it might be appropriate, and certainly the case ultimately has to be decided in Kenosha. But even if he said, yeah, I'm going to go to Milwaukee and I'm going to move for a change of venue on May 7th, he gets up there and he sees the result, I think it's still well within his judgment and his responsibility to make the judgment that I'm not going to do it because it doesn't make sense for the client. And along that line, the OLR takes the position that there is clear direction from the client to do that. That's not in this transcript. She acknowledges she's in no position to give clear direction. The OLR alleges that the Family Court Commissioner gave clear direction. Did not. Family Court Commissioner said, if you want to do it, here's the way you do it. That's not clear direction to do it or not. It's just saying how she thinks it ought to be done. But the OLR also takes the position that after getting this result on May 7th, where there's no visitation assured throughout the summer, he should have gone back and immediately filed a motion for change of venue. To what end? Well, I can imagine that discussion with the client. I just was up to Milwaukee. We had a hearing. There's not going to be any visitation, no matter what, between now and August 1st. But I'm going to go back next week and move the case to Kenosha, or ask to move the case to Kenosha. What will happen there? I don't know what will happen there. Will there be a hearing before August 1st? I don't know. What will the Family Court Commissioner be like? What will the lawyer be like? I don't know. He had a certain thing for 3 months.
Counsel, I would like to move to count one, dealing with the unreasonable fees, allegedly, and I'm looking at your brief, Appendix 28, where it basically goes through the research, and I believe there was 26.3 hours at $200 an hour for a total of $5,260, which the OLR is saying is just not justified and is unreasonable.
Yes.
First of all, I'd like you to just address for me, before we talk about the contract itself, just the research that was done. So if one were to track this, how would I know what research has been done?
Well, I can tell you what the record...
Yes.
Pardon me?
You can tell me what research is.
Yeah, I can tell you what the record says about this, and I hope I get it right. The efforts that we made in May concerned, as I recall, which of these two cases is ultimately going to be the controlling case. What happens if the visitation case...
That was the 4.4 hours. And I guess I'm not even going to... This isn't conceding or understanding, but I wanted to talk about the additional research that was done subsequent to that.
I believe that the research then in July had to do with the question... What happened on July 19th, the judge in Kenosha put the TPR case basically on hold, making it what I would call subservient to the visitation case. And I think what he was working on in July had to do with that question. Can that be done?
Was there anything showing, any written documents, any memos, anything showing?
I don't think so. I think there were cases that were printed along this line that were in his file, but I know there were cases that were printed on those dates that were in his file, but exactly what they... I mean, I didn't look at those cases carefully. But they had to do, I believe, with the subject that I mentioned to him. And then in August, this was after the August 1st hearing, and it is time now, he believes, to bring the matter of jurisdiction and venue to the judge and to ask for a de novo hearing and to ask for a change of venue and to ask that the case be dismissed on jurisdictional grounds. And this research there is primarily in connection with the question of whether the lacking affidavit under 822.09 is a subject matter jurisdictional issue or not, an issue on which there is, as I understand it, no case law in Wisconsin, and he was looking in other jurisdictions to find that.
But what, if any, documentation was there of that research?
Again, I think there were some cases printed. And the formulation of the memorandum and the motion, which cited what he could find and specifically said that I've done a nationwide search and have not been able to find authority on point. And may I also say that on the question of this fee, it's undisputed in the record that while he put certain things into the bill as he was doing it, it's also undisputed that he obviously did other things. For example, he never put in the time record for starting the TPR. He never put in the time record for speaking to Mr. Mason or communicating with the court in any way. So there, as the attorneys who testified indicated, and as Mr. Ward indicated, not everything shows up on the bill. And in that respect, I'll grant you, it's not a perfect bill. But I also don't think it has to be in order for it to be an ethical bill. Also bear in mind that when Mr. Ward writes research, especially in August, that's research and drafting in addition to, you know, looking for the cases. And I'll also say it may seem like a lot of time, but I've had cases myself where I thought I could find an answer and I couldn't. And I spend hour after hour looking and still can't find it. Go to Marquette Law Library thinking I'll find it there. I can't find it there.
Counselor, what's the rationale for not giving her back the remainder of the money? I mean, it was $200 an hour. I understand it says non-refundable. But, you know, when you have an unhappy client, most practicing lawyers don't stand on that. Why didn't he just give her back the $2,700 or whatever was left over at the end of the time?
But he was asked the kind of things that he considered about doing that, and the things he indicated were how much time have I spent, how difficult has it been, has she been a good client, has she been...
He offered to represent her at $200 an hour. Didn't say she had to be a perfect lady in order to get that rate. So I don't understand. To me, that doesn't make any difference what kind of a client she was. He got paid for all of his hours on the bill. The OLR found the hours were excessive, but there's an amount of money that he says, he himself says he didn't use up. Why didn't he just give it back?
Well, I think the agreement that he had with the client, and which the client understood, was that it would not be refunded. It would be non-refundable. And so I think the reason he did that, in addition to, and I guess I tend to disagree with you, that whether or not a person is a cooperative client versus somebody who is getting mad at him when she lies, I mean, I think something like that does impact. But the fact is that it was a non-refundable fee.
But I'm sure when she agreed to a non-refundable fee, she expected to have representation which was in line with what she thought she was obtaining, correct? So you got two sides of the story. He says it's non-refundable, and she says, yeah, but you didn't do what I wanted you to do.
Well,
I'm not happy with you, so.
Well, she wasn't happy with him, but that's true. Then I guess you get into the question, is that warranted or not? But I don't think it's a big, but what she actually said is, I knew it was a minimum fee. I knew it was non-refundable. I know what non-refundable means. And the way I read it is, if he did the preliminary initial stuff, I knew I wouldn't get my money back. So she wasn't thinking and didn't understand. There's no evidence that she understood that if he didn't use up all the hours, she would get a refund.
Yeah, but you're talking contract law to me, and I'm talking to you common sense about a lawyer's service of the public in an ethical fashion. And part of it is people have to feel the services they've gotten have been worthwhile when possible. And this certainly doesn't promote that, does it?
In this particular instance, I don't think she was going to be happy unless she got the money back. I agree with that. But, I mean, I will tell you, too, in my earlier and more naive days, I did some family law and stopped doing it. And the primary reason was because I never had a happy client.
Well, there's a lot of emotion. I agree with you. It's an emotional.
I mean, I thought I was doing the right thing, but nobody was pleased.
Counsel, I understand that. I wanted just to call your attention to the document itself, which is Appendix B2. It's I'm reading the second page of the contract. I don't know whether this is a standard contract within the legal industry or not, but I would ask.
This is the hourly fee agreement.
Yeah, and this is basically paragraph 6 or item 6. It says, client agrees if the client violates any of the office policies listed in paragraph 5, such violation is considered a major breach of this contract and will form the basis for the attorney to cease representing the client, which basically happened here. Now, that was because she wanted him not to work for her anymore. But when I look through the reasons that if the client acknowledged, agrees to appear in court at least 15 minutes prior to any scheduled, are you maintaining that if he ceased to represent her because she violated this, that he would be able to get the money? Or is the difference because she terminated his?
No, I believe that she did violate that contract, and in this sense, it says in one of those paragraphs that if she has a complaint, she will something to the effect that if she has a complaint, she will make an appointment, she will sit down, we'll talk about it, and she will give us an opportunity to remedy whatever whatever the problem is. So in other words,
1.6.
Thank you. It's like a right to cure, and that didn't happen here. She cornered him after the hearing and read him the riot act about some irrelevant stuff, like you should have argued more about the picture and you should have argued more about the name change, and without acknowledging that, hey, maybe if you lie to the family court commissioner, it's not going to work out so well. And then after yelling at him about that, terminated him. Didn't say, let's sit down and let's talk about the next thing or anything. It's just, you're done. And so, and she's entitled to do that, but I do believe that that's a breach then, and I think he's entitled to keep that money.
Counselor, Justice Wilcox started out by saying, is this a standard form for a fee agreement?
Well, I can tell you that the evidence in the case says that minimum non-refundable fees of this type are absolutely used all the time, especially in Kenosha. I mean, that's what the evidence was in Kenosha anyway. Whether this particular form is exactly that same way or not, I don't know. Mr. Ward said that he had drafted it. I believe he probably took some forms and made some alterations and came up with it. I mean, he's not trying to run away from his agreement. He agrees in it with it, but it's very typical of the kind that are used in this kind of work in this area. Thank you. My time is done.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Crone, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Thank you. May it please the Court. My name is Robert Crone, and I appear on behalf of the Office of Lawyer Regulation. On the subject of diligence and on the subject of the fee agreement and the fees charged, the referee's report is very thorough, very detailed. Her findings are consistent with the record and are not clearly erroneous. On the subject of diligence, the Court inquired as to what the expectations perhaps of the client were regarding venue. This is a client, Ms. Summerhill, who lived in Kenosha. The child was in Kenosha. The child was schooled in Kenosha. The ex-husband's father came into Wisconsin, into Milwaukee, I believe from Illinois. Everything about the situation mandated that it be heard in Kenosha, because what was going to happen in Kenosha was a plan to terminate his parental rights and any contacts of visitation or otherwise with his child. And on page 21 and 22 of the transcript, when Ms. Summerhill was asked about the question of venue, I asked her, all right, now in terms of these two matters, the one in Milwaukee County and the one in Kenosha County, did you discuss where it would have been best for these cases to be heard? Answer, yes. Question of venue as it came to be known. Answer, yes. Question, what was discussed regarding that subject? I was told that because my daughter and I resided in Kenosha, that it would be best for the case to be in Kenosha, because if Mr. Ward had to travel back and forth to Milwaukee, that would accumulate a lot of fees. Counsel, Mr. Ward, had it off his office in Kenosha. Furthermore, after this first family court commissioner hearing, again, Ms. Summerhill talked about the order that came from that, came out of that hearing, and I asked her, did you ever talk about the provision of the order with your attorney as to the need to file with the judge or whether he would file with the judge? This is referring to venue. Ms. Summerhill said, he, referring to Ward, basically just stated that it would be filed. Anything that needed to be filed would be taken care of. Question, were you of the impression this Milwaukee matter would ultimately go to Kenosha? Answer, yes.
Mr. Crown, question for you, if I may. I think it's clear in this case that the client wanted this matter heard in Kenosha. That comes through loud and clear. But it's also been argued by Mr. Ward that he had tactical reasons for not doing so. Since the standard is whether or not the referee's findings were clearly erroneous, we have to look at what the referee looked at. How does the referee know that there was no tactical basis for the attorney's decision?
Because the tactical reasons simply make no sense in terms of this record, to put it quite honestly, Justice Butler. This attorney, Mr. Ward, the very first appearance in Milwaukee on May 7th, The very first thing he does is ask for a change of venue. That's inconsistent with now telling us we didn't want a change of venue. And the family court commissioner says, well, that's nice, but you have to file the statutory rules, 80152, file that with the court, and the court will grant you your change of venue. He doesn't do that. So
as I understood it, there was some, at least his position was that because the client had lied to the family court commissioner, he had some concerns about, in Kenosha, had some concerns about transferring the matter down to Kenosha.
Right. Okay. I'm trying to answer your question in three steps. Number one, what he did is inconsistent with what he says now was his strategy. On two occasions in Milwaukee, the only two occasions before the family court commissioner, he asked for a change of venue. That doesn't square with his suggestion now that that didn't make sense for a tactical reason. Moreover, at the time of the hearing, contrary to what you just heard counsel say, his grand strategy was based upon the notion that the guardian ad litem that was appointed in Kenosha, Mr. Mason, was somehow hostile to his client because his client, Ms. Summerhill, had somehow thwarted or interrupted Mason's right to interview the child, to ultimately make a recommendation as far as termination of parental rights. And because of that hostility, counsel, Mr. Ward, has said, we wanted to keep the case in Milwaukee because there would be a guardian ad litem appointed there eventually. The two guardian ad litems would talk, and eventually Mr. Mason would come around to our belief that there should be a termination. That's not supported in this record at all. First of all, the correspondence between Mr. Mason, the guardian ad litem, and Mr. Ward shows that there was absolutely no hostility demonstrated by this guardian ad litem towards this mother or her child. There was a suggestion that the mother interrupted or interfered with the visit, with the interview process with the guardian ad litem. In fact, there was testimony from the mother that she didn't do that. She was concerned about it, but she didn't interfere with it, and she was prepared to proceed with it. But what happened in Kenosha was interrupted or didn't proceed in Kenosha because the attorney for the father, who had earlier appeared in Milwaukee, sent a letter to the judge in Kenosha and said, basically, we were just in Milwaukee. I didn't get any notification that there was going to be a TPR. I'm mad as can be. And there's this matter pending in Milwaukee. And the judge in Kenosha said, well, maybe we shouldn't do anything now until Milwaukee acts further on it. This was not a part of some strategy on the part of Mr. Ward. This was a circumstance that just developed in the case.
I guess my question goes, and I understand what you're saying there, and I understand the assumption that this is a circumstance and more rationalization. But in the face of the two attorneys that testified for Mr. Ward, which is the record that the referee heard, would it not have been better to have any expert testimony on the part of OLR to rebut what those two attorneys said?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe that was necessary because those two attorneys in cross-examination, on direct examination, they said, well, yeah, it makes sense to keep it in Milwaukee because the guardian ad litem was hostile. Then those attorneys were asked, well, how do you know this guardian ad litem was hostile? Did you review any correspondence? Have you spoken with the guardian ad litem? Have you seen anything in the court papers, in the court orders that reflected any problems in this regard? And the expert said, oh, no. Well, where did you get that information? Well, Mr. Mason told me that. The referee didn't buy that, frankly, didn't find that was credible. And now Mr. Ward suggests that there was another strategy, one that was really not well articulated in front of the referee, but now that we've heard, and that is that on May 7th, the family court commissioner didn't do anything, so therefore maybe it was best just to let things lie, so to speak. But that doesn't make much sense either, if you think about it, because the whole idea was to get to Kenosha to terminate this man's rights to parental rights so that he would have no visitation. The matter was still pending in Milwaukee. It was going to be called back, and it was called back for further proceedings in August. Visitation would have been inevitable to the father as long as his parental rights were intact in Milwaukee. And so the client's interests were simply not being served by not filing the change of venue as he had promised to do. Not a contractual promise, nothing in writing in that regard, but certainly a meeting of the minds between lawyer and client as to what this attorney was going to do for his client. So the referee didn't accept the explanations of Mr. Ward, And the experts that he brought in, fellow attorneys that were acquainted with Mr. Ward, who primarily were brought in to talk about the legal fee issue, I should point out, who incidentally talked about the diligence question, she said, I'm not giving those witnesses essentially the testimony much weight because all they said was based upon what Mr. Ward told them, and the other facts don't square with what Mr. Ward is now saying was his rationale. Fact of the matter is Mr. Ward simply didn't do it. He simply didn't file the motion for venue. He's got a very elaborate, technical, esoteric explanation to offer as to why he didn't do it. He simply wanted to do it, was directed to do it, had pretty much indicated he would do it. All benefit would run to his client had he done it. He simply didn't do it. And I don't know why, but I do know that the referee rejected his explanations.
Counsel, I want to shift your attention over a little bit to the issue of a return of part of the retainer agreement.
Yes.
And what is bothering me is the fact that there has been a judgment when there was a suit for the return of this money, and the judgment said, no, Mrs. Summerill, you don't get the money. Now, I understand that the interest that OLR is proceeding upon here is the violation of an ethical rule that he charged an unreasonable fee. And I, in my mind, can separate that easily from the remedy which is tacked onto it by the referee, and that is that money goes back to the client. I have concerns based on issue preclusion, not claim preclusion, because in my mind the issue is, does Mr. Ward owe Ms. Summerhill a refund of part of the retainer? Can you explain to me why I shouldn't be concerned about that, please?
Well, yes. Issue preclusion was attempted as a defense here, and it was a subject of a summary judgment motion before the hearing, and then it was revisited, I believe, at the time of the hearing, but it was before the referee. First of all, the disciplinary case involved a count of diligence.
Right.
And that's not a part of any small claims action that Ms. Summerhill.
I'm not concerned about the claims. I'm concerned about the remedy. The remedy in small claims was you don't have to pay her back any money. You don't owe the money.
But the remedy in small claims was a product of that proceeding in small claims where an unrepresented lady not conversant with the law was denied access to the system because she didn't have an expert, basically, and a summary judgment was
granted. Well, that was her choice. She filed the suit.
But the merits of the issue of the reasonableness of the fee were never in front of the civil trial judge.
Well, you have a summary judgment. They were before the judge, and it is a judgment on the merits. Summary judgment is a judgment on the merits.
Well,
so I'm having a problem with that, with what we're being asked to do here.
But my understanding of this issue claim preclusion is that ultimately...
They're separate now. I want you just to focus on issue preclusion. Claim preclusion requires privity. Issue preclusion does not. And that's why I'm looking at the issue preclusion.
Okay, but under either theory, it's my understanding, I could well be wrong in this, but it's my understanding the court looks at the fundamental fairness of the procedures that led to the judgment to determine if there's some similarity as between the nature of the proceedings such that the final judgment in one should have some finality in the other procedure.
And why would you think the first proceeding wasn't fundamentally fair?
I don't think it's the total issues of this fee were looked at by the court. I think you have an unrepresented plaintiff. You have a court that's deciding it based upon, I believe, the argument that she didn't have an expert and maybe an expert was required. So the merits of the question of whether this was a fair fee weren't delved into at all, much less the way in which we dealt with it in the context of a disciplinary action.
Well, there isn't. So what you're telling me is that it was dismissed on procedural basis, not on substantive
Correct.
Basis?
Correct.
Okay, I'll have to think about that one a little bit. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. On the subject of fees, we understand that under certain facts, a non-refundable fee can be legitimate and is not per se wrong. However, this referee, I think, correctly said that this is essentially not a flat fee where counsel would say, I want $10,000, I'll handle your divorce or whatever from start to finish. This was a fee that is described as non-refundable, but if you read paragraph 2, which is Appendix 4 of the appellate's blue covered brief, it talks about a non-refundable minimum fee of $10,000 to cover the initial work and filings in this action on client's behalf, and an additional fee of $200 per hour for all work after 50 hours. Now, that to me, while it's described as non-refundable, that's somewhat confusing, because it strikes me that a layperson would say, well, I'm buying 50 hours of work $10,000. I think that's one explanation. And whatever the situation, the attorney who drafted the contract, if there are ambiguities, it should be construed against him. But whatever the case, this court has relied upon the test found at 21.5A to determine reasonableness. The criteria set forth, there's 8 or 9 factors that this referee looked at very carefully in the context of this fee. There's no upside risk to this fee. Under this fee agreement, if attorney decided or got ill or decided to retire from law practice the day after he got his $10,000, under his argument, he could keep the $10,000 and never appear in court.
Mr. Crone, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a minute. Maybe I'm not, but I think I am. You have an attorney who's being investigated and then charged by OLR, and we're really dealing with one client, right?
I'm sorry.
One client here. It's not like 10 complaints of 15 clients and repeat. I mean, we're dealing with one client and really dealing with 1 to 2 causes of action that the client, that the attorney was to handle for the client, namely the TPR plus the visitation. And OLR has always been seeking just a public reprimand?
As far as I know.
Okay. And so when I looked at this case, and the devil's advocate looked at this case, he saw one client, saw a public reprimand. I mean, we're not looking at a suspension of the license for a million years. And I went through these exhibits sort of carefully and went through a pile of materials submitted by Mr. Nelson in his OLR dismissal, which included a long report by OLR to the preliminary review committee,
yes,
which he had, that detailed why the preliminary review committee should go ahead, give the go-ahead on this, right?
Right.
And then in addition to all this other stuff, I read a 38-page, if not a it's close to 30. Nope, I'm wrong. So in the appendix, a huge report by the referee, right? Just very lengthy, very detailed. I'm not being
38 pages.
What?
38 pages.
That's what I thought. On this complaint, you know, covering everything. Ms. Barron is a hearing examiner, I think, in federal agencies, so she knows how to do it and did. And now we have briefs here by both you and Mr. Ward running probably close to the maximum allowed. Maybe yours isn't, but his is. And we're having an hour of oral argument. And so the devil's advocate might say, OLR is spending a lot of time, and something like $15,000 in fees so far. Did I remember that correctly?
I don't know.
Okay.
I frankly don't know that.
So far on a one-client complaint, which is going to be a public reprimand. And the devil's advocate might say, if he or she were a cynic, that with 15,000 lawyers in the state, give or take a few, and 20,000 you know, in state and out, that clearly there must be somebody who's done something worse than Mr. Ward that would be deserving of all this attention. And so the devil's advocate has a sense of unease about the case, which is sort of bigger than the details of this case. How do you reassure the devil's advocate?
Well, I reassure.
If the question is off the wall and you shouldn't respond to it.
I was wondering where this was going.
Well, that's my problem.
Is this too much? Is this piling on? Is this overkill?
Maybe that's what I'm saying.
Is that your
question? I'm sort of trying to put it in a perspective of somebody from the outside reading all this.
Well, first of all, in terms of the time that was invested, I should point out in terms of this litigation, I hope maybe I get a little extra time to answer this in light of the length of the question. But a lot of the time in litigating this was a result of Mr. Ward's attack, if you would, on the very disciplinary system in Wisconsin. You're aware of a pending motion, and you're aware of issues as to the fairness of the PRC's evaluation. There were some discovery requests. There was motions for summary judgment on issue of preclusion, all of that. So what we took to be a relatively simple case in terms of prosecuting, we didn't have an expert. We presented it to a knowledgeable referee. A lot of that time, I must say, was a result of the very, very vigorous. I'm not questioning the willingness of Mr. Ward or suggesting it wasn't proper, but a lot of our time was a result of their challenges. Now, that's a partial answer. The other answer is, I think this is a serious case, but obviously it's not so serious to warrant, in our view, a suspension or a revocation. Mr. Ward does have a previous private reprimand. He has been reprimanded before by the court. This does involve a fair amount of money, and this is a client who was vulnerable in terms of the personal issues involving her child, who was not a woman of means, and who suddenly had $10,000 invested. And quite honestly, if you look at, take a big picture view of this, she really didn't get much for that $10,000. She was in a family court commissioner setting on a couple of occasions. The case was filed at TPR in Kenosha, and then everything kind of blew up. What she didn't want to happen and what Mr. Ward suggested probably wouldn't ultimately happen actually did happen. That is, her husband got visitation in August, much to her consternation, wants her money back. And then she goes to another attorney, Patricia Brown, who invests 2.7 hours in doing a nominal amount of research, didn't use any of the work product in Mr. Ward, made two appearances, one to get that venue change and then to terminate the parental rights in 2.7 hours. So if you put it in that context, you have to ask yourself, should this court be concerned about the reasonableness of the representation and the fee that was provided to this lady under the rationale of the non-refundable retainer agreement? I think it's an interesting and an important question for this court. I think it's a serious violation in terms of the fact that this was a relatively simple case, that I think there was a fair amount of unnecessary manufactured legal work done to justify a fee, a lot of it after he either knew or was largely suspicious of the fact that he was going to be terminated. So I think it's a serious case, and I think it warranted prosecution and warrants our being here today. And I think I didn't make the decision as far as public reprimand. That's made internally at OLR. But they look at these factors and they compare it with other cases, and they thought a public reprimand was appropriate.
So from the client's perspective, even though from maybe a broad perspective of the profession, at least from the client's perspective, it was a very important case because she thought she got milked out of 10 grand, or at least, if not the whole 10 grand, a substantial portion thereof.
Well, she got that, and she didn't get the result that she ultimately got from another attorney rather quickly. Yeah, but from the public standpoint, which is more the reason that we're here, I think it is a legitimate opportunity for the court to address this question of diligence and to address this question of what's an appropriate fee arrangement, or are these types of non-refundable fee arrangements simply non-refundable, and do they guarantee the lawyer $10,000, or do these reasonableness standards built into the rules still apply? So I think there are some legitimate questions here. I like to think we're not here just to prosecute Mr. Ward for no other reason than to prosecute him.
So the kind of case that involves excessiveness of fees by lawyers, which may be a may or may not be a substantial problem in cases, and doing the work for the client.
Yes.
And, explaining to the client what you're doing or not doing.
Right. And if it is excessive, what does the client get back? Speaking on behalf of OLR, I believe they legitimately thought those were important public issues for the court.
Isn't this in part just a result-driven case? In other words, would you be here saying, advancing an argument that none of this research was really warranted if she got what she wanted?
That's so hypothetical. In other words, if this research ultimately resulted in the filings of some paperwork that led to her getting a successful...
As I recall the referee's discussion, the referee didn't buy it that he did all of this research. In fact, you know, you guys asked for a couple thousand refund, and the referee said there's no way he did all this research. Maybe I'm saying more than it's there, but that's my recollection of what the referee said. So is it unethical if he got the results she wanted but still charged for research that she found he didn't do?
Well, I doubt whether we'd be here as a practical matter if she got the results she wanted. This was driven by her grievance.
And that's one of my concerns. If it's unreasonable in that he really didn't do it, isn't it unreasonable? I mean, it's asserted that he didn't do it. Isn't it unreasonable regardless of what the result is or not? Let me see if I can find where the referee notes discussion when she's indicating that you're only asking for $2,200. I do not agree with these figures. Essentially, the combined total of fees earned by Mr. Ward, she says, is only $4,780. And I assumed that was because she didn't think that the research really warranted.
We didn't think the research through a certain date, after a certain date, was necessary, and we suggested a $7,000 refund. She gave Mr. Ward the benefit of some doubt on the research that was done up to a certain point and suggested roughly a $5,000 refund.
Okay, thank you.
Why did Darnell Harris, let me rephrase this. Does the record indicate why Darnell Harris gave up in the TPR so quickly?
No. The record indicated that Ms. Brown testified, and as I recall, she testified as to the hearing, that there was some negotiations. There wasn't a full hearing on that. He ultimately agreed to give up parental rights, and they were terminated. I don't think that, quite honestly, involved much litigation. I think it involved a day or a part of a day in a court proceeding and an ultimate stipulation, if I remember that correctly. I don't know why he did that, but he did that.
Was there ever any child support?
I don't, frankly, know the history of that. I'm sure there was initially a child support order. I don't know what the history of his payments were. That wasn't really involved in some of the issues before this referee.
Mr. Cron, let me ask you this, because I think this is what's bothering me. When I went through and I read through the briefs, and I listened or read what OLR had to say about this case, everything clicked. It all made sense. Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, that sounds like too much. Yeah, it sounds like they didn't do what they were supposed to do. And then I went back and I looked at the findings of the referee, and what I was left with was, but where's the proof? What's missing here? It sounds wrong, but it almost seemed like a burden shifting to the attorney, that he had to show that he didn't do these things wrong as opposed to OLR showing that he did do them wrong. And I kept looking, well, where's the evidence from OLR that the fees are unreasonable. He was the one who presented the experts. Where is the evidence from OLR that there was no basis for a tactical decision? I can understand why you conclude that it sounds like it doesn't make any sense, but where was the evidence to show the referee that it really didn't make any sense? And that's what's been troubling me with this case.
Well, you look at the record of what happened in the court proceedings, virtually nothing. There was a token appearance initially, a request for change of venue, and then no paperwork filed for change of venue. And you don't have to have an expert to show that. And then he comes back, or then files a TPR in Kenosha and really doesn't follow up on that. And then he has suggested his rationale for that. I just think...
All of those things, he seems to have an explanation. And the explanation may be bogus. I'm assuming the explanation probably is bogus. What I'm getting at is, where was that shown to the referee?
I think the referee did feel it was bogus and didn't feel the explanation was logical. And that logic would suggest that he simply didn't follow through. I don't think, and I've argued this before, I don't think the OLR, every time there's an attorney appearing on behalf of a respondent, has to counter with another attorney or a psychologist against a psychologist or whatever. I think that if the burden of proof is met, the referee, just like any trier of fact, a court or a jury, can listen to an expert and can... and this referee did comment upon the testimony of the experts and essentially rejected it. I don't think you have to buy into what an expert says and ignore the other proof just because he or she is an expert or qualifies as an expert. I think that there was ample evidence in the record as to Mr. Ward's inaction. He didn't file any paperwork. There wasn't any evidence of any paper. Somebody was asking about documents that were filed. In fact, there were no filings. And again, Ms. Brown put in 2.7 hours to get the job done from start to finish. And logic would tell you that...
Ms. Brown is the other attorney?
26.3 hours of research by Mr. Ward. You wonder, what do you have for that? There's nothing to show for it.
I'm sorry, Ms. Brown is the other attorney?
Ms. Brown was the successor attorney for this client, Ms. Summerhill. So you have these factors, and you can look at all of these facts, as this referee did, and you can say, this doesn't seem reasonable. And then she did go through went through all of the items of the reasonableness standard for fees. And only one of them seems to suggest that an expert might be necessary, and that relates to what is a customary fee in the locale. You might need an expert for that, but keep in mind that's only one of seven or eight factors. And the other factors, as the referee pointed out, don't require an expert, and the fact finder can make a determination based upon those factors in the absence of a lawyer coming in and saying one thing or the other.
Who testified on behalf of OLR?
Ms. Summerhill testified on behalf of OLR. Her current husband, if I'm recalling, testified on behalf of OLR. And we questioned Mr. Ward adversely, and I believe that's... yes, Patricia Brown, the successor attorney, I'm sorry.
So on the basis of that, those testimonies, you could get in at least Ms. Summerhill's understanding of the change of venue issue.
Yes.
You could get in, because of the adverse examination, what the strategy was, if any.
Yes.
And you could get in what another attorney did in the same case with a minimal amount of work.
And we did do that.
And on that basis, and then what happened after you put in your testimony?
Well, for instance, Ms. Brown testified the work product that Mr. Ward apparently sent her, she didn't even use. She testified that to change venue, she looked at, I think it was 801.52, and it was a simple motion without contest, and the court granted it. She got a fairly easy determination of termination of parental rights. Apparently the father had thrown in the towel by that point for whatever reason. So you have her efforts juxtaposed to Mr. Ward's efforts, her bill juxtaposed to his. You look at what the legal services, what was required and what was done, and that was, I think, compelling to the referee. And in addition, she looked at the specific factors for unreasonableness and applied them. In other words, did this preclude other employment? didn't, other than Mr. Summerhill's former husband. Is there a longstanding relationship with his client, Ms. Summerhill? There wasn't. All of those factors were looked at in addition. I see my red light is on.
Thank you, Mr. Crone.
Thank you.
Mr. Nelson, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. Let me just clear up a couple of inaccuracies. The words called by the OLR were Summerhill, Patricia Brown, and my client adversely, the father, the husband was not called. The assertion that Attorney Brown got this wrapped up real quickly is incorrect. She incurred well over $5,000 in fees. And the reason it came to an end was because on the day before the hearing, they had a pretrial conference, and the judge pointed out that there were two guardian ad litems who had taken positions contrary to the father and two lawyers sitting there ready to go contrary to the father. And the father at that point realized that this 12- or 13-year-old girl by that time did not want her as the father, and so he said, rather than go through it, I'm just going to give up.
Well, just so I don't, did I misinterpret? You said that Attorney Brown's fees were $5,000, or maybe I just, what did you?
I believe that's right.
Okay.
They're in the record. And
was that for 2.7 hours? And if so, was that reasonable?
It's inaccurate to say 2.7 hours. 2.7 hours is what it took her to do the venue motion. Okay, and she didn't even read what Mr. Ward had prepared on jurisdiction. Mr. Ward had decided to make a motion on subject matter jurisdiction, and that was what he worked on, and that was what he prepared. And that was what he sent to Attorney Brown, who decided not even to read it. Now, I understand the attorneys can have different tactics, and I respect that. But to say that somebody spent too much time because successor counsel didn't even bother to read the work product, I think that's a little shallow. I mean, if we're going to get after him, say it's lousy work product, or it's completely crazy to think that you've got a subject matter jurisdiction issue here or something like that. But to say that you did the work, no criticism of the work, but it wasn't used because the lying client fired you after the hearing, he did the work. And I should point out another inaccuracy is she didn't use anything that he drafted. In fact, she admitted at the time of the hearing that two things that are significant. Number one, she testified that she used verbatim the affidavit, the lengthy affidavit that he had prepared for this motion. And she also testified that it was important that they ended up with the case in Milwaukee because the guardian ad litem in Milwaukee was important to the ultimate resolution of this case. You know, there are certain parts of this case that are simple, and there are certain parts of this case that are complicated. OLI doesn't seem to understand the complicated parts. They want to say it's just a simple case. The simple part that they don't want to accept is the explanation for why after May 7 there was no motion for a change of venue. And it is not a bogus reason, and it is not, as Mr. Cohn says, somehow inadequately developed in the record. The pages involved, I think, are page 359, when Mr. Ward is testifying, and pages 286 to 287 and page 346 when the experts were testifying, and they all testified that there was no reason to move it. I just want to respond briefly because I find myself being something of a cynic after this whole thing, too. And I know you can't do this, but explaining to lawyers in this state that the OLR is spending its time persecuting a person over a 3-month delay for not bringing a discretionary change of venue motion that can be brought at any time and that made absolutely no difference in this case is monumentally a waste. And I tell you, I've been so upset about this as a member of the bar watching this happen. And the level of, I don't know what you want to call it. I'm telling you, the OLR has misrepresented this record. They made a misrepresentation in their initial complaint. The briefs that have been filed here do not accurately represent the record. The referee has, well, I don't even know how to say it, done everything possible to twist this record to achieve the result of rubber stamping an inappropriate and inadequate and actually false investigation. And I think it's important that we not just accept that this seems on a surface level to be sort of make some sense, because it really doesn't. And I remember picking up the Milwaukee Journal one day while this was going on, and while I was spending countless hours working on this and reading that at the same time they're going after Mr. Ward about this, there's a convicted felon sitting in prison holding his law license. And I see my time is up, but can I just briefly mention a couple other things? The ORI has proposed a new exception to the hearsay rule, credibility. Credibility counsel. We can admit antagonistic, peevish letters from another attorney during a case that the ORI has because it goes to credibility. If that's true, we might as well throw the hearsay rule into Lake Manoa. The ORI is asking for special rules here, rules that normal litigants do not have to do not get the advantage of, but that for some reason the ORI should have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson, and thank you, Mr. Crone, for your arguments today on 03-0349-D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Ward. That concludes our hearing in this matter, and the court will be in conference at 3:10. Thank you. We are in recess until tomorrow at 9:45.
In answer to your question, Chief Justice, state that Mr. Charles' husband testified he was there when he was.
Thank you, counsel.